It's Wednesday, October 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, polls show a big lead in the race for the White House. Are they valid measures of the candidates?
It is significant because this has happened in Balochistan. This has happened close to Quetta.
Also ahead, a deadly attack on a Pakistani police academy. The advance on Mosul prompts meetings about the fight itself and human rights. And new music from Maroon 5. It's all on today's International Edition. Election Day is just 2 weeks away. Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton campaigned Tuesday in Florida. That's a key battleground state that is pivotal for both candidates seeking the U.S. presidency. Florida in the southeastern United States is the largest of the battleground states, those closely contested by the two main candidates, with the winner set to gain 29 electoral votes, more than 10% of the total necessary to win the White House. The most populous states having the biggest influence on the Electoral College rather than the overall national popular vote determine the election. Surveys in Florida show Clinton ahead of Trump by 4 percentage points. About 1.6 million of Florida voters have already cast their ballots either in person or at polling stations set up for advance voting or via absentee ballots. Public opinion surveys show Trump is trailing Clinton by about 5 percentage points across the country. Trump has also fallen behind Clinton in other competitive and always closely contested states. He is visiting 7 cities in Florida over 3 days, telling voters that he is ahead and mocking the surveys that he calls phony polls that say the opposite. He contends the national media have joined with the Clinton campaign to create a rigged election, although he has not offered any evidence. In the polls that we've been following, one day Trump is indeed up, but the next day Clinton outpaces him. And what makes that difference? The science of data collection in the United States has changed over the years, but the results still vary depending on who conducts the poll and how it's conducted. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti brings us a rare look inside a polling location in Pennsylvania to reveal how polls are done.
She's up 6%. No, he's up 6%. If they vary so much, can we trust political polls?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
David Dutwin is in charge of methodology at SSRS, a survey firm, where hundreds of interviewers work on 20 opinion polls a day.
Hello, ma'am. My name is Russ Land.
Internet polls are unreliable. Door-to-door polling costs too much, so companies use phones. But
lots of things have changed.
Part of the problem is in your pocket. 9 out of 10 of us own these instead of these. Hello?
Half of the United States households don't own a landline telephone anymore.
Hello, my name is Valentina Martinez.
Laws forbid recorded calls on mobiles, so real people have to do the interview and are met with this.
Like, oh, well, I'm busy, and then they'll just hang up right away.
They don't have the time, they're busy, they're driving.
Using a In fact, it takes up to 40 calls to get one single interview.
Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. When would be a better time to call you?
But calling a cell has its benefits, says Courtney Kennedy of Pew Research.
We're able to reach a lot of the groups that were traditionally hard to reach, such as young adults, African Americans, Hispanics, that we really struggled to reach on landlines.
Participants are typically reluctant to give their opinions on issues. But this election, interviewers say they can't get them to stop talking.
Yes. Oh, my gosh, yes.
Interviewers like Martinez ask the same questions verbatim, so the answers are statistically valid. 1,000 participants is the magic number, because a sample that size has the same demographics as the U.S. population. And the combined results carry a low 3% margin of error, which is crucial to remember when looking at the fluctuating polls. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, in Allentown, Pennsylvania.
As we ponder polls, we check out the pulse on social media. And as always, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me right here in the studio with trending stories. Hi, G.
Hello.
Let's begin with Iceland. What's happening there?
Jim, it is not every day Iceland is trending on social media, at least not as often as it did back during the 2008 financial crisis. The Nordic country is trending Tuesday because it's the Women's Day Off.
Okay, what does that mean and how are they celebrating?
by leaving work early. You know, that's the kind of protest that I can get behind. Thousands of Icelandic women left work at 2:38 p.m. local time to protest wage inequality. In Iceland, women earn some 30% less than their male colleagues, and going by the figure, 2:38 p.m. is roughly the time they would start working for free if they were to work a regular shift. The trending hashtag is the Icelandic word for the Women's Day off, which I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce, but it's spelled K-V-E-N-N-A-F-R-I. People are posting photos and videos at the protest using the hashtag.
Okay, well, what else happens to be trending?
With only 2 weeks left, the U.S. presidential election is, of course, a trending topic. And the next story is actually generated by social media. American late-night talk show Jimmy Kimmel Live has a section called Mean Tweets, where celebrities read negative tweets about them on air. And this time, that celebrity was President Barack Obama.
All right, I've got to know. Tell us a couple of the tweets that he read.
Sure, here's one. Bro, do you even lift? To that, Mr. Obama said, I lift the ban on Cuban cigars. That's worth something. The last tweet he read was from GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump, who tweeted, President Obama will go down as perhaps the worst president in the history of the United States. Now, to that, Obama's reply was, at least I will go down as a president.
Ouch! Well, since we're doing a social media segment about a TV show about social media, we do have time for one last story. What do you have?
U.S. self-driving transportation company called Otto collaborated with delivery app Uber to deliver 50,000 beers in Colorado. And people are saying, well, why didn't it exist when we needed a party? Well, back to you, Jim.
All right. Thanks for that wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter at our Twitter stream for International Edition at VOA_IE or our own individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, President Duterte's U.S.-China policy pivot adds to ASEAN uncertainties. Scandal undermines South Korean constitutional reform effort. Will public outcry in China spare Jia Jianlong from controversial death sentence? Four killed on Australia amusement park ride. North Korea lashes out at threat of more sanctions. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website and also through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. At least 61 police cadets were killed and dozens wounded in an hours-long attack and hostage-taking by a handful of gunmen armed with explosive vests on a police academy in southwestern Pakistan. Dozens were wounded before security forces ended the attack on the police training center near the city of Quetta, the capital of Baluchistan province. Islamic State has claimed responsibility. But Muin Chima, a Pakistani analyst at the Australian National University, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the Sunni militant group Lashkar-e-Jhangvi has links with the Pakistani Taliban and has a history of carrying out sectarian attacks in the area.
Mostly targeting Hazara Shia minority in Balochistan. So it had a very sectarian agenda, and for quite some time the state tolerated it or did not take this kind of sectarian terrorism very seriously because it was very much focused on the Taliban insurgency further north in the northwestern part of the country, especially in the federally administered tribal areas. But more recently, over the last year, the state has taken these sorts of sectarian militant outfits also seriously, and the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi has particularly been targeted. You know, notable leaders were killed by the police in an attack a few months back. So clearly there is motivation for Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. If it is confirmed that it is the Lashkar-e-Jhangvi which has carried out this attack, there's clearly motivation because they have been targeting public officials and now the military as well in retaliation for the intelligence-based operations against them.
Well, this is one of the largest attacks by militant group in Pakistan just this year alone.
It is significant because this has happened in Balochistan. This has happened close to Quetta. Balochistan has acquired immense geopolitical significance, as well as within the Pakistani political context. It has acquired a lot of significance. It always had significance, but it has been in the limelight for a very, very important reason, which is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. There is a plan by Chinese government and state corporations to invest something to the tune of $46 billion, or the number keeps increasing, actually, in Pakistan on a number of infrastructure projects, many of which go through Balochistan, leading to the port of Gwadar further down south. So Pakistan's military is very concerned that neighboring countries, particularly militants based in Afghanistan, might see this as an opportunity to disrupt the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC as it is known, and it has been increasingly nervous about militancy in Balochistan.
Mawin, how is the counterinsurgency effort by the Pakistani military going against these groups? Are they winning? Are they gaining ground?
Over the last couple of years, the Pakistan military launched a massive operation in which it has claimed tremendous success in the federally administered tribal areas further north. The military is definitely claiming success in a continuing fight, but given the complexity and the nuances in the kind of militancy that Pakistan has experienced, the chances are that this is a tough fight to be fought over many, many more years to come.
Two other major attacks by jihadists have hit Pakistan this year. More than 70 people were killed and hundreds wounded in an attack targeting Christians on Eastern Sunday in Lahore. More than 70 other people died in an attack on mourners who gathered at a Quetta hospital. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says he expects military campaigns against the Islamic State's two strongholds in Iraq and Syria will likely overlap. He spoke in Paris after a meeting of 13 countries that are a part of the U.S.-led coalition fighting Islamic State. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from the French capital.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says that even as Iraqi forces advance on Mosul in Iraq, the coalition fighting Islamic State militants is laying the groundwork for another operation against the group in its stronghold in nearby Raqqa, Syria.
Yes, there will be overlap, and that's part of our plan, and we are prepared for that. Second, there's no delay. This is proceeding on plan, even as Mosul is proceeding on plan.
Carter spoke at a news conference alongside French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, who said taking Mosul from IS would have a major effect on the terrorist group in terms of resources, organization, management, and leadership. Mosul is particularly symbolic because IS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi announced his self-proclaimed caliphate during a 2014 speech in the city.
Le pseudo-califat, il est un califat territorial.
But Le Drian warned the coalition must destroy what he called the Islamic State's virtual caliphate, along with its territorial one. He also said it is difficult to pin down movements of IS forces between Mosul and Raqqa and other besieged cities. Earlier, French President François Hollande also warned of terrorists hiding among streams of people trying to escape Mosul. The United Nations has said the Islamic State may have massacred scores of people around Mosul as Iraqi and Kurdish forces advance on the city. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And the United Nations Human Rights Office says those atrocities against civilians in Mosul by Islamic State militants reportedly are increasing as Iraqi soldiers close in on the embattled northern Iraqi city. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the UN office in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is receiving disturbing reports of the extrajudicial and summary execution of children and women, as well as male civilians in Mosul. It says it also has received reports of Islamic State militants deliberately using civilians as human shields to prevent them from leaving the city. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says it is difficult to verify the reports because they are still being vetted by UN monitors, but he says the breadth of cruelty that emerges from the preliminary reports is staggering. For example, he says UN staff in Iraq has received reports that IS, also known as ISIL, killed 15 civilians in a village near Mosul and threw their bodies into a river so as to spread terror among other residents.
On the afternoon of 19th of October, that's last Wednesday, in the same village, ISIL reportedly tied 6 civilians to a vehicle by their hands and dragged them around the village, apparently simply because they were related to a particular tribal leader who is fighting against ISIL alongside the Iraqi government forces. The 6 men were also allegedly beaten with sticks and gun butts, and it's not clear what happened to them subsequently.
Colville says his office has reports of the killings of nearly 80 other civilians and 50 former Iraqi police officers by IS in the following 4 days. One victim, he says, was a disabled child who was lagging behind a group of civilians being forcibly removed from a village outside Mosul.
We very much fear that these will not be the last such reports we receive of such barbaric acts by ISIL. And we repeat our call on government forces and their allies to ensure their fighters do not take revenge on any of the civilians who escape from areas under ISIL control, and that they treat all suspected ISIL fighters they capture in accordance with international humanitarian law.
Colville says his office is very concerned by severe measures being taken by authorities in Kirkuk in northern Iraq against internally displaced people. He says the Kurdish security forces have been evicting hundreds of families from their places of residence, apparently in retaliation for a surprise IS attack last week on Kirkuk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The push against Islamic State in Mosul is seen as a pivotal operation, and as developments come about, you can follow them all on our website at voanews.com. Be sure to also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE for all the latest updates, and check out our Facebook page at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
On November 8th, American voters will choose their next president. We'll provide you with the latest updates. Will it be Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Will third-party candidates like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein have an impact on the final outcome? What does that mean for Americans and the world? It's all here on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. The pop rock band Maroon 5 has just released a new album. In International Edition, Sarah Williams talks about it with Border Crossing host Larry London.
First, let me tell you a little bit about the band. They come from Los Angeles, California, and most of the members attended UCLA together and were in an a cappella group known as Cara Flowers at the time. But they went on to get a pop contract in the early 2000s and got a Grammy in 2005 for Best New Artist for their debut album, Songs About Jane, which has added to their collection of record sales that totals about 20 million albums so far and 70 million singles worldwide. And Maroon 5 are international superstars. In fact, in June, they marked the 15th anniversary of their debut album and became UNICEF ambassadors as well, helping UNICEF support kids around the world. They've collected 3 Grammys, 3 American Music Awards, 4 Billboard Awards, and a World Music Award in 2004 for the world's best new group, which is quite an honor. And so now their 5th album is called 5, or the Roman numeral V. And they've been on tour for that in support of the new album since it came out in 2014. And Adam Levine also spends time as a coach on The Voice, which is a very popular TV music contest type show. And in addition to that, he's also a new daddy. This past year, his supermodel wife, Bahati Prinsloo, gave birth to their first child, Dusty Rose. So he's been a busy guy.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And they've got a new song out, which is just... it's just climbing up the charts very, very fast. This is a hot new tune, and the new song is called Don't Wanna Know.
I don't wanna know, no, no, no. Who's taking you home, oh, oh, oh. I'm loving you so, 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 so. The way I used to love you, no. I don't wanna know, no, no, no.
Okay, great. Well, as you were saying, he sounds like a very, very busy person. He's got a lot going on.
Yes, yes, in addition to being on the TV show, and he's just agreed to return for the next season, which starts in, I believe, January. He's finishing up the current season of The Voice, and then he's coming back on top of touring and on top of recording songs for their new album, which will be their sixth album. And all of that's going on in his life, taking care of a baby at home with his wife, Bahati Prinsloo. The baby's name is Dusty Rose. The new song, Don't Want to Know, has debuted at number one on the Billboard Twitter track charts. What that means is that people are talking about the song. People are downloading the song. It's very, very popular on social media. So it has debuted at number one. And already in just a matter of days, because it's only been out a week, it has sold close to 2 million copies in just about a week's time. So that's pretty amazing stuff. And Adam Levine made the video for that. You see him driving in a car, a convertible top. He's dressed as Pikachu. And apparently it looks as though he's playing the game Pokemon Go, which everyone is playing these days. So it's kind of a cute tongue-in-cheek video. And it's a great song called Don't Want to Know. I love Adam Levine, love Maroon 5, and they are stars all around the world.
And I wonder if their next album will be called Six.
Yeah, you never know. That's a very good question, Sarah. I'll go call him and ask.
Okay. Thanks a lot. That's VOA's Larry London. He's the host of Border Crossings. I don't want to know, no. Who's taking you home? I'm loving you so.
You've been listening to International Edition. You'll find us, you know where, at our website, voanews.com. You can also find us on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Dan Crafton. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all here in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you have a nice day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In mid-October, the foreign ministers of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation member countries met in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, to find new ways to promote peace and prosperity and fight radicalization and rein in violent extremism. In the belief that education is an important tool to promote peace and economic development and to combat the ideology of terrorism and violent extremism, the dignitaries adopted the theme Education and Enlightenment, the Path to Peace and Creativity. To facilitate the process of countering violent extremist ideology online, the organization also launched the Center for Dialogue, Peace and Understanding. The ministers adopted the Tashkent Declaration, which, among other goals, strives to promote peace and combat violent extremism by addressing problems caused by underperforming economies and high unemployment through increased investments in human capital, training, and quality education. Such investments should result in a well-educated populace that values and works toward achieving democracy and toward modernizing and improving their home countries. The theme of this year's ministerial, Education and Enlightenment, appropriately focuses on the solution to many of the ongoing challenges facing OIC members and the international community, said Acting U.S. Special Envoy to the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, Arsalan Suleiman. Education and innovation are the currency of the modern global economy. A well-rounded education is what has enabled our global civilization to achieve such great advances in all areas, from technology and health to tolerance and pluralism. It is what helps us break down the mental barriers that divide us. We must work together more closely to jointly address global challenges like the refugee crisis and climate change. We must also recognize the urgent need to enhance global efforts to protect the rights of minorities, including religious minorities, said Special Envoy Suleiman. The United States is proud of the progress in enhancing U.S. OIC cooperation in a number of areas, including on political crises, humanitarian affairs, health, countering violent extremism, women's rights, entrepreneurship, and human rights. We look forward to working with all of you to further enhance U.S. OIC partnerships and cooperation.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.